We listening to that People Power Radio, WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice. Let's go.
This is a journey.
Nothing about it.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Say what you say. Say what?
I don't want to be like Mike.
Before Magic's knees go permanently south for the winter.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Changing up the guard quicker than fear brings down doo-doo. Young bro.
He never saw Elgin Baylor play during his day or Oscar Robinson.
Flash the dice roll back. The big O was jackknifing through all them bodies.
I didn't know nothing about it.
Welcome, welcome to The Collision. This is the show where sports and politics collide at your home for jazz and justice, 89.3 FM WPFW. I'm Dave Zirin, joined as always by 11-year NBA player, activist, author, and all about man about town, Etan Thomas. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing pretty good, Dave. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing wonderfully because we have an extremely special guest this week. Can you tell us who the guest is before I tee him up even more?
Yes, this is the great Tommy Shepard. He was assistant GM for the Wizards. My guy, we had a great relationship. Our families know each other. And, he's just a great guy. So it's really an honor to have him on the show today.
Can't wait to bring him on. Before we bring him right on, a very quick word, and this will tee up what we want to speak with Tommy Shepard about. Mm-hmm. A very quick word about a live episode of The Collision with an audience that we're doing this Saturday at 9 p.m. Yes, you heard correctly. 9 p.m. It's going to be awesome. To be held at the Bus Boys and Poets on 450 K Street. This special event will include Washington Wizard Hall of Fame player and broadcaster and personal hero of mine, the great Phil Chenier. And we'll also be speaking with former player Javaris Crittenden. And Etan, we're going to be speaking about Javaris and his story with Tommy Shepard. But can you background it just a little bit before we bring Tommy on?
Sure. So, I played with Javaris with the Wizards, and everybody knows what happened with him and Gilbert. And, after I watched the Netflix documentary, and we talked about it here on the show during the summer, but I watched it actually with my son and my wife, Nicole, called Shooting Guards. And it was kind of telling and breaking down everything that transpired. After I actually reached out to Tommy Shepard, I said, hey, because he was in the documentary a lot and, giving perspectives and talking. So I said, hey, could you give me Javaris's number? I just want to text him, tell him I'm happy that he's out, praying for him and everything like that. And he said, sure. You know what I mean? He would love to hear from you. And I text Javaris and told him just that. And he said, okay, let me hit you right back in about 10 minutes. And he hit me back and we talked for like 2.5 hours.
Wow.
And he was saying how, the documentary really left out a lot of things. He's like, I talked to him for like 3 hours and they only put like a tenth of what I said. And, they didn't tell anything about my redemption story, all the stuff I'm, doing now, all the stuff I do with kids. They didn't tell any of that. I was like, oh, wow. I was like, well, if you want, I'm still here in the DMV. and I have connections with a lot of different places. I could set up some different things, and you know, just when you're ready, we can do some talking and get your story out. And he said, okay, I'm gonna hit you back on that. And then he hit me back, and I set it up, and now we're here. And it's great to have Tommy Shepard on here to talk, because he really has a tremendous amount of respect for you. And I don't know if he's expressed it to you to this level, but he told me, and he said that you were somebody that was always in his corner, always positive with him, encouraging of him, you know, even at his lowest point. So I just wanted to let you know that, if he hasn't expressed that to you himself.
Mm. So let's bring Tommy Shepard on. I mean, this is somebody who really is DC Hoops' foundational person for some of the best memories we've had in this town at the pro level, at the men's pro level over the last 20 years. An honor to have him on the show. The DMV Zone, Tommy Shepard. Hello, sir. Thank you for being on with us.
Hey, thank you so much for this opportunity to catch up. It's always great to see you. Dave, you've been one of the caretakers of the game, truth tellers of the game forever. I respect your work tremendously. Don, I can't properly express to you how much respect I have for your voice out there and for holding people accountable, but particularly what you're trying to do for Javaris. You know, I just, that subject breaks. It's heartbreaking in so many ways, but I'm so looking forward to what comes of this for him and his future, you know, because you got to acknowledge a deep respect to the family, you know, who lost a loved one. You know, that pain is real, and there's nothing we can say today that's going to lessen that magnitude, not at all. But I care deeply about a human being who's seeking redemption and where his story can go, because we can focus on behind it and nothing's going to change that.
Right.
But what can change is him helping some other people, uplift other people, give them a roadmap to avoid, to be a warning, to be a redemptive story to others, you know. And I'll let it, with that, I will throw it back to you guys, but I really want to acknowledge that family, but I want to acknowledge what we really hope for Javaris is about his future. It's not about revisiting the past. It's not trying to change things that can't be changed, but man, he can be such a light to others. And if he can prevent things that happen to him and what he put himself in harm's way with, if his story can help avoid that for other people, that's something that I think would be blessed.
And that's what we're doing here. Actually going today, this afternoon, we're going to a correctional facility. So when I was with the Wizards, and shout out to Sashia Jones. I had to give her props. But I always wanted to go and speak at the correctional facility. And she was like, okay, this isn't a normal request to have, you know what I mean? And she supported me. And we connected with this group called Free Minds, and they're right there. And they speak with, they have juveniles under the age of 18. So they're going to get a second chance. So me and Javaris are going to go speak to them, and he's going to tell them, you know, encouraging them, be open about his mistakes and things that he did and how he was able to turn his life around, and hopefully being a positive voice for them. And then tomorrow we're going to go and speak at a youth organization, a youth group called Unashamed, with my church, First Baptist Church of Glen Arden, Pastor Jenkins.
Pastor Jenkins, that's fantastic. You know, Pastor Jenkins,
yeah, and so he's in, you know, and I really got to, you know, say thank you to Kelly Taylor from Free Minds and Pastor Jenkins, because when I told them about it, they didn't even hesitate. You know what I mean? And Andy Shalal, you know what I mean, with Bus Boys and Poets. They didn't hesitate. They was like, oh, that sounds great. We would love to. So we're going to do three events in a row, you know, today, Friday, and Saturday. And I want to ask you about the level of, you know, support and encouragement that he talked about that you gave him. And that's not something, and he framed it because he didn't get that from anybody else. And he was very clear about that. You know what I mean? He was like, he realized he made a mistake. He was at his lowest point. What was the nature of your relationship and that support and encouragement that you was giving him?
Man, we're all here for each other, you know, and I owe my life, the life that I have for my family that we provided to NBA players and every one of them that served when I worked for the Nuggets, when I worked for the Wizards, you know, they made us have a fantastic life. And I owe that to every one of y'all. who ever did anything in my career. Mm-hmm. You know, I get a little choked up thinking about in your darkest moments, who does come forward? Because, man, there's a lot of people celebrating on draft night. There's a lot of people celebrating playoffs. There's a lot of people doing those things. But when real life comes and you're looking around and if there's not too many people in your corner, life gets really hard, gets really dark.
Right.
And I think more than anything for me, you know, having spent time with Javaris far before any of this stuff had happened, but I know who he is, who he came from. You know, I go back to Wallace Prather, some of the great people in his life that stood by him, and he deserves respect. He deserves redemption if he seeks it. And it was very clear to me that this is somebody that really wants to do the right thing. He certainly can't change the past, but he can hopefully change the future for other people. Mm. And he needs that. And I'm, who am I to ever deny anybody, you know, the opportunity just to be uplifted, just to have a friend, you know? And so I don't want to make too much of it, but between him and I, but I would tell you that I'm grateful. He's somebody that I think is very deserving of an opportunity to make the future brighter for the world.
Mm. If I could ask you, Mr. Shepherd, who was
Tommy? Come on, man.
Tommy. All right. I got to start with respect and then work my way.
Hey, I heard you say 20 years. We had some tough ones too. Now, if you're truly going to be a truth teller, hey, we should have won some more damn games in my time.
Hey,
that's on me. I own it.
But you gave us some moments that honestly were some of the best moments of my 17-year-old son's young life. So, you know, things like that are not things I take lightly either.
Thank you.
So you've created a No, I know. You credit the players. I'm crediting the whole organization for just creating a tableau for a lot of kids to have some wonderful memories. And that those aren't going anywhere. Trust me. I did want to ask you about the Javaris you knew and how you've seen him evolve over the years and what you saw in him as a young player, not just as an athlete, but as a person that made you pay some attention to him.
Well, it was an interesting time when we acquired Javaris, you know, because he grew up in Atlanta. His story is pretty well documented. He's another kid that didn't really go too far, right? He went to college at Georgia Tech and grew up in the ATL. And then all of a sudden, one day you're drafted and you go across the country to Los Angeles, which is exactly unlike Atlanta. And everything that comes with playing for the LA Lakers, he got launched into a totally different career, totally different environment. And it didn't work out for him well with the Lakers. And then he went to Memphis in a trade. And when we acquired him, we saw somebody that we were hoping young legs, defensive minded. Let's talk about the player. There was opportunity there, we thought, to have a maybe a reclamation project on our hands, because he didn't really get a great chance up in LA, up in Memphis. And for us, he kind of fit what we were looking for. The person, you know, he was a straight A student, Dwight Howard's point guard in high school, but the Atlanta Celtics, the late great Wallace Prather, one of the big influences in my life, started the Atlanta Celtics. Javaris was, you know, he co-signed on Javaris as a young man. We talked to him before the trade, and, you know, I had no concerns about the person and what he could do out on the court, everything. What I've seen as he's grown and gone through a great deal of darkness coming out on the other side is true contrition and humility that's required to move forward, knowing that, hey, this is going to take a long time for me, and don't try to do it all at once, but making the world a better place that fits the Javaris I knew when he was a young man. He always was a good person who wanted to make the world better back then, not just on the court, but certainly the things that he did off the court. And, you know, it was very, very puzzling. All the things, again, I'm not trying to revisit anything, but the person that I was speaking to when he was released on the phone, he was taking his daughter to visit colleges. She's a college basketball player. We talked about being a parent, talked about all the responsibilities all of a sudden that come at you when your kids are in college, different than when they were little. because now they can talk back to you and they're smarter than you and everything that we know kids do. And it was fun. It was neat. It was relieving. It was, you know, a great opportunity. And I hope people will continue to try to uplift him. Tom, what you're doing, I can't tell you enough how much that means to this kid and what that great opportunity. It shows him hope. And that kind of all aligns, Dave, with what I remember him as and what I see now.
You know, I wanted to get your take because I watched the Netflix documentary, you know, twice since then. And, you know, I had a few issues with it just because I don't think that they told the whole story. Of course, I didn't tell Javaris's redemption part and, you know, so much of him. They focus so much. And I understand sensationalism. I understand Netflix. I get it. But I feel like it should have been like a whole series and add a different part because a lot of the people who, you know, have come to me around the DMV have always asked me, how is Javaris doing now? Mm-hmm. And that should have been answered in the documentary. But what was your reaction once you saw the final product of the shooting guards doc?
Well, it's always baffling how you try to capture all those years of life and what's happened in people's lives in an hour documentary. And you're splicing in all these different things. And it almost got to be where you're literally sprinting through all these memories, all these people's opinions, all these things, and trying to compress it. And the narrative that formed at that time did not reflect where Javaris is today and where his future is. And my hope is there's another documentary forthcoming sooner than later that shows the progress he's made and the impact he's made in lives. And I think that's probably the best way to look at it. No documentary anymore is really going to be the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth. There's a lot of narratives that get put in and injected. And, you know, again, I'm not really trying to revisit the past as much as I look at it. I do hope for his sake. There's another filmmaker that comes forward and watches him and watches his progress and has that documentary ready to go that tells a tremendous redemption story. He deserves that, but he has to do that. Mm-hmm. And those steps are every day. And as you know, people are going to check us every day. And they don't really care about what you say. They check your actions. Mm-hmm. And his actions need to be, you know, the video has to align with the audio.
Right.
And I think that's the things that he's doing. And people like yourself that give him that platform to show that. I can't say it enough. Let's hope this gets contagious.
Wow. Tommy, honest and true. You clearly have a very humanistic approach to these players. You cared about them as human beings. You charted their progress beyond just what was on the court. I know this might be a tough thing to answer, but do you think that is typical or atypical for the culture of an NBA team?
I couldn't answer that. I just know for myself that that's the only way I can roll.
Where does that come from for you? Does that come from how you were raised? Does that come from how you were educated about the sport? Did it come from a particular mentor?
No, I had fantastic parents. We had two special needs sisters in my family, and I think that raises your level of sensitivity to there's a lot of meanness in the world, and you kind of have your radar up for that. But 30 straight years in the NBA, you know, it's easier to win Powerball than it is to play one single game in the NBA. And these players are amazing, some of the most amazing players on the planet. And to play more than 100 games in your career like Javaris did, you know, that puts you – there's less than 2,000 players in the history of the game that have ever done that. And his numbers, you know, the numbers are staggering what it takes to play a night in the NBA. So they're amazing, gifted athletes that need a ton of support. They come from all over. If you follow the game these days, there's over a quarter of the NBA's international, totally different backgrounds, and you bring them all together and you make it work. You have a team and they go out and they perform every night, and the love of the game is certainly there. It's a business. There's no question. And fans vote with their feet. But to get to the NBA is so incredible. I think I just was in such admiration, but really so much gratitude. Again, I got a chance to be with the best players on the planet for 30 years, and I'm very grateful to all of them. You know, stuff like, you know, last week we lost a great, great person in Rodney Rogers, right? Rodney and I were together in Denver back in the day. We lost Mutombo, and years ago we lost Bison de LA. Three guys off of those 94, 95 team that I was with in Denver. And that hurt to the soul. Those guys were very close to me, just like Atana is today. You know, just like all the players that I ever want to keep in contact, I'll always care deeply for them. You know, even the guys that were challenging, because I'm sure I was challenging to them sometimes. But I think if we all can look back and say, hey, what a ride, what unbelievable bonds we make, and you don't realize it till much later. You know, Atana and I went through a really difficult announcement in his life for his health, mm-hmm. and sitting there in a room going, I guess we really don't care about who the hell we're playing tomorrow, do we anymore? Right? There's other things that come up. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget that time where we were sitting there and just trying to help be present to you, because there's nothing I could say. Right? There's nothing I was going to be able to say that can change where you were. I just wanted to be present. I felt that's what that moment needed. And that's just how you have to be in this industry if you really want to, I think, make it matter. It's not transactional, man.
Right.
Let me say this though, and I got to be honest with you. Tommy Shepard is different. let me answer your question, Dave. Okay. Tommy Shepard is different. You know, I played 11 years in the NBA. You know, I've you know, seen a lot of GMs, a lot of assistant GMs, a lot of management people. I don't keep in contact. I don't have much of a relationship with any of them the way I do with Tommy Shepard. Our kids know each other. You know what I mean? I've been to his house and we rode the scooters my daughter Imani was on the horse and having a great time. There's a different level. We were, you know, we happened to see each other. Where were we at? I forgot the name of the school, but it was a homeschool program, co-op.
Yeah.
And we saw it. It was like, hey, what's going on? And we sit there talking. We're supposed to be quiet because the people are giving a presentation. And me and Tommy Shepard are sitting there talking. And I mean, there is a difference in his approach with players. Like you said, a more humanistic approach. Not everybody has that. You know what I mean? And the reason why Javaris said that, you know, he gave you so much props and said that you cared about him, you took an interest in him as a person, as a human being, and that's not regularly done. So I just wanted to say that real quick before we, you know what I mean, skip by it, because you definitely are special. And
thank you.
Make that point. But before we let you go, because time flies, I do want to ask you, is the door open for you to come back to the NBA?
I think
that the NBA is definitely, I think you're missed. I think what you bring to the table. You know who else I was talking to is Calvin Booth.
Great guy.
He's saying your praises as well. And and you know, I just want to know, is the door open? You know what I mean? Do you want to come back, or what the rest of that process looks like for you?
You know, yeah, I had some opportunities already that have come up, and a lot of them involve moving. And after putting my family through 30 years. Of as I told Dave the story, you know, I said 30 seasons of marriage, and you know, like, wrong thing to say, but this is our home, and so
people that
wanted me to move, that wasn't going to happen. But you know, I spent 2 years going around the world just trying to be curious and learn. Why can we keep getting our play? Why are our players always constantly injured? What can we do to help mental wellness, mental performance, and then. The biggest thing is how are we going to deal with gambling that's now in sports? And that's a whole nother conversation for another day. But those things are real, and they're going to weigh down on the NBA. They're coming at us like a freight train. So I really wanted to learn a ton. I went and got a certification in executive leadership coaching, because I think that's really, really, really needed right now. I think people need to create some space for themselves to be the best version of themselves. They got to step back. I think we all squeeze way too tight in the NBA. We take it way too serious in the moment, and it really has a huge impact on who we are as human beings. And that really gets reflected back at home. It gets reflected in our own health. You know, we all give up on day-to-day health care for the job, and that's not how it's supposed to be. So I promised my wife I would get myself straight. I would get my sleep sanitation right, get my health right, and then we'll revisit that. And so I'm ready. You know, I'll get back to work. I'm doing quite a bit of consulting stuff and a lot of fun things I'm undefeated the last couple of years, which is, feels great, but I miss it. I miss, you know what I miss? I miss practice. I miss the times, you know, before chapel. I miss just things that we can kick around when, you know, right before the gladiators about to go into the Coliseum. It's just so much fun being around that kind of setting. I miss the players' banter. I miss coaches. You know, the highs are never high enough to cover some of the lows, but it's just basketball. And so you step away from it for a while and you really realize, man, it was about the people. It wasn't about the wins and losses.
Yeah, but you have time for one more question, Tommy.
I got all the time in the world for you guys, man.
Awesome. All right. I didn't want to let you go without asking this question as somebody who's been so enmeshed in DC hoops. A certain former Wizard, and I'm not going to say his name because this interview has been so much about positivity. I'm not going to name someone to bash them. But this certain former player goes to another team, praises that team's fan base, and says, "We didn't have it like this in D.C. I don't feel like the fans in D.C. were particularly connected to the team. There was no energy when the Wizards played." And he really bashed kind of like the organic D.C. culture of hoops. And I wanted to give you a chance to respond to that, about this idea that we're kind of a dead zone when it comes to people who love the game and who are fans of the NBA.
Basketball in the diamond, in the district, is the biggest truth teller you'll ever know. You have a great product. You get guys who bust their ass, come to play every night. They will come and they will fight for you. They will be as loyal as possible. I think fans vote with their feet. So if you go to the next place and you talk about how great their fans are, maybe you might want to try it harder at your last stop, you know. But I know this. These are great fans here.
Yes.
And they celebrate it. And, you know, some of the greatest memories, you know, you think about the playoffs and some of the things that we went through. And,
yes,
man, nothing ever replaces that. And I think the fans in D.C. are some of the very best basketball fans in the NBA, hands down. I think you got to earn their love. By the way that you play out on the floor, this is not something that's just going to be given away. And that's what we all professional athletes look at this in a way that I think, hey, this is your job. This is a great distraction, diversion for people. They come, they want to see a good show. They want to see you put out your very best. I don't think people go to games and years later remember the score or maybe even who won or lost. They just remember, man, those guys were great people. And Atan's group, they came through, and every one of y'all just done so many amazing things after basketball. But how much you love the fans back then, and they loved you back. And I think that's something that we all carry, and you always want to recreate that. But people that leave, they can have their own opinions. But I know I've been around this place, okay, for more than 20 years in D.C., greatest fans. Uh-huh. Oh, until Phil Chenier, I said hello. That is a legend.
You're a legend. Absolutely.
What a great guy.
Hey, I really appreciate you coming on. Really appreciate your words about Javaris. You know, I've always had the utmost respect for you. So
likewise.
And I'm looking forward to seeing you come back and being involved in the NBA. Definitely take care of your health and promise to your wife, get everything straight. But then you got a lot of work to do and a lot of work left that you could do in the NBA.
Well, my blessings to you. I wish your family the very best, Dave. Coaching girls basketball is no joke.
No, it's not.
You better come right every day or they're going to let you hear about it. So good luck to you.
Thank you. I'm gearing up already.
You guys take care.
All right.
Take care.
Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's a thrill.
Bye.
Tommy Shepard, Collision audience. What an incredible gent to have on. Etan Thomas, thank you so much for facilitating that. And thank you for the work, Etan, that you're doing with Javaris Crittenden. I mean, because that's going to, you know, John Carlos of the 68 Olympics always talks about throwing the stone in the lake and not judging it by the splash, but by the ripples.
Right.
And you get the feeling that you bring somebody like Javaris into a correctional facility, that you're creating ripples, ripples of effect. And that's a beautiful thing.
Definitely.
We got to go to a break right now. Bottom of the hour, we have a public service announcement to play. I also have a demonstration ad to read. But first, let's go to the public service announcement that's going to be played right now by Magic Mike. We are The Collision, where sports and politics collide here on WPFW, trying to change this world one broadcast at a time.
This is Medea Benjamin of Code Pink with the WPFW editorial. As Washington escalates towards confrontation with Venezuela, opinion polls show that in the United States and Venezuela, the majority oppose U.S. intervention. Yet instead of listening to the people, the Trump administration is charging ahead with escalation, labeling Venezuelan officials as terrorists, asserting the right to strike vessels in the Caribbean without evidence or congressional approval, tightening sanctions. This week, President Trump said something important, that he is willing to talk to President Nicolas Maduro. We hope so, but let's not be naive. The U.S. has used talks before as a cover for military action, including against Iran, engaging diplomatically one day while preparing strikes the next. So we have to ask, is this a sincere step towards peace or the prelude to something far more dangerous? The fundamental truth is that Venezuela is not our enemy, and war is not the answer. 28 million Venezuelans have already endured years of economic warfare through sanctions that block medicine, fuel, and basic goods. A U.S. military strike would only ignite an internal conflict and shatter countless lives. We've seen this story before: Iraq, Libya, Syria. So today, Code Pink calls on the White House to honor the will of the people and calls on Congress to rein in unauthorized military force and lift sanctions so Venezuelans can rebuild their own country in peace. For WPFW, I'm Medea Benjamin with Code Pink. You can learn more at codepink.org/Latin America.
We are back here on The Collision. Tom Thomas, not with us at this point, the 11-year NBA vet. Tommy Shepard, former leading NBA executive, not with us at this point. Chuck Modiano, though, in the house right now, about to bring Chuck on, our illustrious co-host, to speak a little bit about some of his recent experiences. I mean, it's been like, where in the world is Chuck Modiano? I'm remembering that game I played with my kids. Where in the world is Carmen Sandiego? This time we're going to do, where in the world is Chuck Modiano? But before we do, I want to make sure everybody knows that Thursday, that's today, between 11 a.m. and 1 p.m. Eastern, all I'm going to be doing is telling folks that this is happening. There is a Congo is not for sale rally at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. That's the White House. That's today from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. So if you're hearing this broadcast, maybe if you're in your car, maybe you're listening to it streaming through your phone, or maybe you live nearby the White House, or maybe you have a lunch hour, please come out, that this is happening in front of the White House between 11 a.m. and 1 p.m. It's called Reject the U.S. Congo-Rwanda Peace Agreement. Congo is not for sale. Just letting folks know that it's happening. And now, want to bring on the program. We ask the question, where in the world has Chuck Modiano been? Chuck, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing great, DZ. How about yourself?
I'm doing wonderfully. I want to get on this narrative, if we can, and find out, first and foremost, where you've been, why you went there, and what you saw. And then after you give us the overview, I really want to drill in on your experiences in Ireland, which I know were particularly political. So let's start first and foremost with where you've been, Carmen Sandiego. I mean, Chuck Modiano.
Well, I'm going to start second because you just said something. We're talking about what's going on this afternoon relative to Congo. While I'm here, I want to let folks know that there's a protest tomorrow at the Kennedy Center. At 11 a.m. because Infantino, the head of FIFA, is giving a peace award to Donald Trump. This is America in a nutshell, in American sports, in a nutshell. And there are going to be people who are not too happy about that. So that's 11 a.m. at the Kennedy Center tomorrow. So you see why I got to squeeze that
in. You're saying that the person who is extrajudiciously killing people in boats on international waters, murdering them when they've even survived drone attacks, you're saying that this person is about to get a peace prize as he threatens war with Venezuela.
That's exactly what I'm saying. From one gangster to another.
From Johnny Infantino, who is a gangster, but he's also a supplicant. Like his predecessor, Sepp Blatter, was like a godfather. This guy, Johnny Infantino, head of FIFA, is a sniveling worm. And he is somebody who is a supplicant. He is somebody who is a sycophant. He is somebody who lives at the feet of Donald Trump in a way that is so over the top and noxious that when he said, I'm creating the FIFA Peace Prize to give to Donald Trump, for many of us, it was just like, well, of course he is. This That's is a right. ridiculous human being making up a ridiculous award for the purposes of, you know, massaging the ego of the great leader. So it's disgusting. It's fascistic. And it's everything, frankly, that the World Cup shouldn't be. The World Cup should be a place where people come together, not a place that's run by fascistic leaders attempting to tear us apart. And not the least of which, Chuck, and then I want to hear where in the world was Carmen Sandiego? I mean, Chuck Modiano. But it has to be said that the World Cup sites in the United States for the Mr. Peace Prize are also going to be sites of violence. Because they are going to be sending ICE to these sites as a way to pick off people in the massive immigrant audience who are going to push their hard-earned savings to the middle of the table for the dream of seeing a World Cup match. That's all right. I need to say.
Well, I'm glad you said that because it's going to say keep ICE out of our cup. You know, I don't know if you got that. That will be a message tomorrow. Keep ICE out of our cup. So I appreciate that. I'm going to actually circle back a little later to Infantino with it within talking about my Carmen Sandiego travels.
So where have you been, Chuck? Right, where have you been?
I'm going to give it to you really quickly. Really, the last 3 weeks, I started in Greece. I have a nephew, and he's studying in Greece, Thessalonica. Greece was incredible. I saw him there. And then he is going to go to Dublin next semester. You know, I didn't get these opportunities. Nobody said you could study abroad when I was in college. So I'd let him know his little privileged self about his little privileged self as much as I could. And I think he gets it. I think he gets it. But we'll see. That said, then I went to Dublin and then I went to Belfast. And really got into the protest scenes to understand the protest scenes over there, which we will certainly talk about. Love Dublin, love Belfast. Just some great people you meet there right away. And then I decided to extend the vacation. And I said vacation almost because it felt like a vacation, even though I'm covering protests, because it was really meeting people. And where I would normally post videos that I was taking during the day, I was having pints at pubs with people to get to know people. I was doing shots in Genoa on November 27th when there was a strike by Italian dock workers in Genoa, spent a day there, learned a lot there. And then I ended up going on Saturday to London. And London, there was a massive protest on International Solidarity Day for the Palestinian people. It was going on across the world. But the two things I really want to say about London is, one, there are a group of hunger strikers, and you could Google that, hunger strikers who are, I think, on their 32nd day and who have been arrested. And many people, so look out for them. And many people have been arrested, you may have seen on video and social media, because Palestine Action has been arrested and has been labeled a terrorist group for having the audacity to do direct action to stop weapons from going to Israel. And now if you wear a Palestine Action shirt in London, you can and will be arrested. So you see massive groups wearing Palestine Action shirts in solidarity. They know they're going to be arrested, and they're saying, arrest me. Do whatever you have to do. This is the front end of free speech. They're even surpassed. Starmer has even surpassed Trump in some ways in how ridiculous it is over there. So I wanted to speak to many of the people who have been dealing with that, and the, you know, how do they navigate that and uplift those who have been labeled terrorists and have been treated like quote-unquote criminals, all for trying to stop a genocide. So those are the places I've been to, but I really wanted to, you know, touch base on the London point.
Wow, great point on London. So let's talk about Dublin, Ireland, Belfast, Ireland, and race. And yes, what you felt there and what you saw there, because of course it's complicated over there, because of course people like many people who are traditionally ancestrally Irish, let me put it like that, are white and yet not treated like white people as we understand it in the United States historically because of British colonialism.
Right.
So you get a race, you've had a racialized difference, yeah, based on place of birth and based on religion in a way that I think would be kind of shocking to people in the U.S. You, yeah, also, though, now have right-wing politicians in Ireland attempting to be like, well, wait a minute, you know, because they used to say Ireland for the Irish as an anti-colonial slogan.
Yeah.
And now the right wing says Ireland for the Irish as an anti-immigrant slogan. So you could see just how slippery whiteness can, right, become in the context of neocolonization. But it's all, but that history, that legacy of anti-colonialism, anti-racism, solidarity with Mandela, solidarity with Palestine, it's all there. And I want to hear from you how you experienced it and what you learned by being in that context.
Felt so comfortable in collective white spaces in Ireland more than I ever have in America. I'm going to be honest. As someone who, anti-racism is important to me, anti-fascism is important to me, anti-capitalism is important to me, humanity is important to me. There are people like yourself, they're white people that we seek out, we find who have a racist, who have those characteristics, but you almost got to seek them out. You're not going to be around it in a collective. And in this protest space, certainly I was around it in a collective in a way that was so comforting. And to your point, it clearly has to do with Ireland's own history of being colonized. That when they're saying Free Palestine at a rally, and I'm interviewing somebody from, say, BDS Belfast, they sound different than even the anti-racist white person in America that I might be interviewing, who might say, yeah, it's important to be an ally or something like that. I'm not going to minimize any anti-racist person, but I'm saying they're saying it with their whole chest. Yes, free Palestine. The British has been messing with us for years. Now they're doing that to Palestinians. We know about starvation because that potato famine wasn't a famine, and that potato famine was a potato slow genocide. We know what that was about. So let's talk about it. And what? So we have a solidarity with Palestine that doesn't feel like Palestine is something otherized or a different people, that they're right there. And the amount of people, white people, that I just felt just had the best sense of humanity. It was incredible for me because I just haven't experienced that maybe like that in America. So I felt comfortable right away in these spaces, incredibly comfortable. Don't get me wrong, I got a lot to learn. I have a lot to learn about Irish history. And then I did learn through many interviews. So for instance, I'm gonna give you an example. I'm with a wonderful woman in Belfast. She's 75 years old. She's been part of the Irish civil rights movement. And we're walking by a Frederick Douglass statue in the middle of Belfast, outside of Victoria Square, after a Belfast BDS rally to stop shopping at Victoria Square, to stop shopping Reebok, stop shopping Dell, stop shopping all these companies that are contributing to genocide. That is over, and we walk by a statue of Frederick Douglass, who I didn't know till then went to Ireland. And when he saw the conditions in Ireland, he talked about those conditions in on parallel terms in some language that it might have been even worse in some cases. And we're talking about that. And she's giving me a history. And so we love Frederick Douglass here. Not only that, she goes on to tell me, well, you know, the Irish civil rights movement in 1968 was born in many ways and inspired in many ways by the Black American civil rights movement that we saw in the 60s. So when we saw masses of people fighting for their own voting rights, well, did you know as a woman, I couldn't vote till 1970? Did you know that? Do you think most Americans know that? Because this American didn't know that. And, you know, back then, if you were fighting for freedom, if you had even any type of association whatsoever, ties to IRA, you know, you'd come in, people would beat you up, you could be jailed. So we're talking about a history that particularly the older people, those in the 60s and 70s and whatnot, really had felt oppression in a real way, like not like a, in a book learning way about the potato genocide. So I got to speak to those individuals. They could tell me how that civil rights movement, whether you're talking about 1968 and Derry Wall, you're talking about Bloody Sunday coming into the 70s. This is real stuff, right? This is real oppression. And what's different is the Irish person with the accent is very different than the Irish American person who's second generation and now they're assimilating into whiteness. Whereas the Irish person often with the accent in these protest spaces, they know their history. They know what oppression is. They grew up on the history of that historical oppression and you feel it. So I hadn't been in that space before, whether it was Dublin, whether it was Belfast. And I had a chance to cover many rallies, whether it was a BDS Belfast rally to stop shopping for products that support genocide, or another rally, which was to pass the Occupied Territories Bill, which is to stop trade with goods and services with Ireland and Israel. We could talk more about that after I pause. And then the third rally I covered was another rally, which was that there was an effort by our friends we've had on the show, Rebecca O'Keefe and others, with Irish Support for Palestine, to rename Herzog Park. Herzog Park named after Chaim Herzog, who is Isaac Herzog's father, the president of Israel. And that effort's been going on for 2 years, but all of a sudden it got wind before the vote. So Isaac Herzog's talking about it. Lindsey Graham over here in the States is talking about it. And then it becomes the international story. And before the vote, these forces, these Zionist forces, these U.S. forces end up stopping the vote that would have led to renaming the park. So I had a few experiences. And those experiences led me back to the tentacles of America that not only control 95% of U.S. politicians, but control Irish politicians and other politicians around the world.
Wow, an amazing experience for you to have, Chuck, up and down the line. Let's drill it down to Palestine. You know, sometimes over the last year, 2 years in this country, I felt like I'm just losing my mind. Like there's this genocide going on. I'm seeing it on my phones every day. I'm hearing people in the U.S. government say that we actually have worked too hard to educate people on the Holocaust because now people are applying it to other people. I don't know if you heard that, a former speech. Actually, it's the speechwriter for Michelle Obama who coined her last name is Sarah Hurwitz is her name.
And
She actually coined the phrase, when they go low, we go high. That's her, genius. And now she's saying, when they go anti-genocide, we go lower than you could possibly imagine and say, your genocide doesn't matter. Only our genocide can. It was one of the ugliest things I've ever heard saying that, like, oh, we've done too good a job educating people about the Holocaust because now they apply it to Palestine. I mean, I didn't even know what to say about that. That's the country we live in. How did the air feel over there to know you were among people who, as a very commonsensical way, were just like, yeah, we're for a free Palestine and we're for ending the genocide?
I mean, it was beautiful. you know, I have to call out some organizations, Irish Support for Palestine. I have to Dubs for Palestine. Like I mentioned, BDS Belfast. There's so many organizations that are working together. People Over Profit Party. And there were politicians that I haven't heard in New York, in the States, that they sound like activists in ways, and they don't talk around things. So you even have a wing of Irish government who sound like activists. But what I have to say here is that everything I'm saying about the Irish people collectively, and I'm not talking about the Conor McGregor, as you spoke about the right wingers. We're not talking about that racist faction, nor am I trying to paint everyone in Ireland. But what I am talking about is sort of the left wing, you know, base that in America, no one runs on a free Palestine. You know what I mean? We had two parties and both parties were pro-genocide. Mm-hmm. In Ireland, it's so strong that you have to run on a free Palestine to win. So the politicians will run on a free Palestine. The politicians will run on, we have to pass an occupied territories bill to stop all trade of goods and services, and promise that it's been in the works for 8 years. But when it comes time to vote, whether it's the occupied territories bill or changing the name of Herzog Park to Free Palestine Park or Gaza Park, when it's time to vote, they get a call the week before. And that call comes from America. And that call basically threatens some level of sanctions, some level of impacting trade that is going to economically hurt Ireland. And speaker after speaker said the root of our problem is that they're bending the knee to American and corporate interests. And that's why we're not having those. Not the democracy. It's in their interest democratically for these leaders to pass, say, the occupied territories bill or rename that part. It's in their interest. It doesn't happen because of America. And that was my biggest takeaway. And what America fears and will threaten economic harm and sanctions, what America fears that if Ireland is the first domino to fall from Europe, then other European dominoes fall, then the whole house of cards comes crumbling down. Because now you can't just otherize it, as you mentioned earlier, as Palestinians. And basically, let's be honest, we're talking about whiteness. That's the fear. When whiteness joins, we got a serious problem. Because like Hurwitz said, what people have found out who really fight against genocide is that 1948 Geneva Convention, which we took seriously to mean everybody, or us Jews who say never again is never again to anybody, they only meant that for white people. They only meant we shouldn't have genocide for white people. They weren't saying Palestinians. They weren't saying Congolese. They weren't saying Sudanese. And when moral people started applying the Holocaust to everybody, not just white people, not just Europeans, that's when a lot of people said, wow, we educated them too much, to your point earlier.
Or Hillary Clinton saying it's TikTok's fault and not the genocide's fault. But let's not go there. We're at the end.
Okay, you're right. That's the whole show. You're right.
Instead, a little bit of positivity. People are demonstrating from 11 to 1 in front of the White House today for a free Congo. Congo is not for sale. People are demonstrating tomorrow where this World Cup draw is happening at the Vichy Kennedy Center, as I call it. And that's going to be at what time, Chuck?
That's 11. That's
also 11 o'clock. So easy to remember. 11 today, White House. 11 tomorrow, Kennedy Center. And let's not forget Saturday, a special live episode of The Collision, December 6th at 450 K Street, talking to Hall of Fame, Wizards Hall of Famer Phil Chenier, and former Wizard Javaris Crittenden, whose story is something that everybody should know. Chuck, did I get everything?
You got everything. One last thing. I mentioned Irish Support for Palestine is doing great work. Them and a few other groups, I think a Scottish Support for Palestine, have a ICC filing against Infantino, that they the and another and oh my God, I can't believe the name is escaping me. Infantino, you know what I mean? Infantino, so that they're charged with complicity in genocide through the ICC, and it is the first time any sports people of any federation in history have received such a charge. So we'll talk a little bit more about it when I can give you the details better.
That's huge. Yo, thank you, Etan Thomas. Thank you, Tommy Shepard. Thank you, Chuck Modiano. Very glad to have you back. Not that you ever really left us.
Yeah.
For everybody out there listening, please stay frosty. I'm Dave Zirin. We are out of here. Peace.
Some of y'all switch your wallet size agenda to end up with somebody else.
WPFW Local Station Board is hosting a community town hall on Saturday, December 13th from 12 noon until 3 p.m. Our theme is Free Airwaves, Fighting for Community and Public Radio. With the economic upheaval caused by DOGE, the social stress exacerbated by the military occupation of the Capitol, and the harm inflicted on innocent people by ICE agents, it is more important than ever to have an independent grassroots media focused on building communities, amplifying marginalized voices, and driving social movements. The town hall takes place on Saturday, December 13th from 12 noon until 3 p.m. at the Brookland Busboys and Poets, 625 Monroe Street, Northeast in the district. Additional information can be found online at wpfwfm.org. WPFW, building community one broadcast at a time.
Mutual aid, the act of taking care of each other, comes in many forms. One such form is supporting WPFW. At a time when so many are hurting, if you are doing well financially and want to do good, we invite you to give the gift of WPFW. Emancipatory media is truly the gift that keeps on giving. A tax-deductible donation can be made anytime at WPFWFM.org or from Sunday, December 14th through Saturday, December 20th during our pledge drive by calling 800-222-9739. It is your continued support that allows us to do the work of building a more equitable world, one broadcast at a time.
Y'all, I am Jaren with Dreaming Out Loud.
And I'm Ron Motz with the Go-Go Museum and Cafe. This holiday season, Historic Anacostia is bringing joy from December the 11th through the 22nd.
A celebration filled with daily surprises along Marion Barry and MLK Jr. Avenue Southeast. Christmas tree lighting, live concerts at the Go-Go Museum, and holiday meals and deals from your favorite Anacostia businesses.
12 days of festive family fun as you dine, shop, and explore DC's Arts and Culture District. Powered by the Anacostia Bid, artsagogo.org. For more information.
The Congolese diaspora will hold a demonstration in front of the White House at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue Northwest on Thursday, December 4th at 11 a.m. Congolese are calling on people of conscience to reject the Trump administration's peace-for-profit deal. Both the presidents of Rwanda, Paul Kagame, and the president of the Democratic Republic of Congo, Felix Tshisekedi, are in town to sign the deal. Congolese say Congo is not for sale. Demand true justice and accountability for Congolese victims of the Rwandan occupation. No justice, no peace. Following the protest, WPFW will unpack the elements of the deal with the Congolese diaspora at 2 p.m. on Thursday. WPFW, building a more equitable world, one broadcast at a time.
On Monday, December 8th, WPFW presents Saving Our Homes, the crisis in housing and homeownership, in partnership with the Washington Informer and the Missionary Baptist Minister Conference of the DMV. From 9 a.m. until 1 p.m., we confront gentrification, predatory buyers, tax sales, foreclosure traps, and the loss of family homes, defending our elders and keeping generational wealth in our families. The programming continues at 5 p.m., where we'll unpack the lack of affordable housing and the displacement of renters. We culminate in a town hall from 6 to 8 p.m., moderated by Donald Temple and Denise Rolock Barnes, where we welcome listeners' calls. Guests include lawyers, activists, pastors, financial strategists, and government officials. That's Saving Our Homes, the crisis in housing and home ownership, December 8th on WPFW, building a more equitable world, one broadcast at a time.
I'm Candy Shannon, host of Morning Brew, the Friday edition, from 5 to 8 a.m. on member-supported WPFW Washington, 89.3 FM.
We know there's a link. They say code war. We say code pink. It's blood for oil. We know there's a link.